Hello, hello, hello. You're listening to a live voice now. Namely that of Ren to Wheel. Because this is the Mideast Migraine Show brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. And we're streaming live, of course, on our internet radio service, which can be found at www.freakradio.org. Freakradio.org. It is 3:06 Pacific Daylight Time. This Monday, April 21st. Tomorrow will be the 22nd. But it's the 21st of April. At 3:06 PDT. So if those configurations match with your own personal time space delirium, then you know that the show is live and you may call in at any time for the Monday edition of Mideast Migraines. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, and I will repeat this later, area 831-427-3772. The line is open. Direct to the studio here and direct to me. You will talk, I will listen, and then I will talk back at you. In which case, you better listen and listen good to me. All right. The usual snail's pace computer stuff here. We're not even talking snail mail. This is snail email and other stuff on the internet. I guess I've been wondering about that because I've had this problem on my own home PC. Why is it crawling? I just take it for granted. It's just like the situation in any big city where people complain more and more about the traffic, commuting to work or wherever they're going home again. It just gets worse every day because we, as a peoples, are not used to getting with the reality that we have to keep up with an increasing population. And that affects everything, not the least of which it affects our highways and public transit systems. They get more crowded, too. We're just not used to keeping up with those things as we need to. I think the same thing is true with cyberspace. Internet traffic, it just keeps getting more and more, and so everyone is slowing up everyone else. So please, people, when you do your internet stuff, do not jam. I beseech you, do not jam the traffic lanes by overclicking things. Learn to be patient. Exercising a lot of patience makes a big difference when you're doing stuff on the internet or on your email. I suppose it would also help a great deal to upgrade to a stronger broadband width or something like that. I am Ren Tuwheel with the Mideast Migraines Program. Getting with it here. On a high note, from the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, USCIO. If this sucker ever gets with it. And pops up like it's supposed to. I do not want to end up doing anyone a huge disfavor by dragging down my program because I'm waiting for things to pop up on my screen here. So I may end up just like I did a few weeks ago when we did not have computer support, or at least not my email support. I can just read from print if need be. But here we go. Remember BDS, folks? The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement aimed at Israel's cultural and academic environment, resorting to boycotting, divestment, etc., to force Israel to start implementing human rights for everyone, not just its own Israeli Jewish citizens, but its Israeli non-Jewish citizens, as well as those who are not citizens to speak of anyone because they're under Israeli military occupation, until Israel gets with it and starts to be cool and fair to everyone, BDS will be relentless in their efforts to wake the world up to the fact that this is what you have to do. After all the failed obviously violence-based armed struggles, armed resistance efforts have failed, and after so-called peace process, you may as well spell that P-I-E-C-E processes have failed to do anything for the Palestinians. All they've done over time is systematically strengthen Israel's hand in oppression and in expansion of their Zionist state. There's out of that desperation comes BDS, and it's working. When it comes to the almighty dollar, the almighty shekel, as it were, the shekel would be Israel's monetary unit. That's what it takes to get people to listen to you. Shake their piggy bank. Thanks to you, Earth Day Network cuts ties with SodaStream. We are excited to announce that on the eve of Earth Day, and indeed this is dated today or yesterday here, Earth Day officially is not until tomorrow, April 22nd, the traditional Earth Day, but here in Santa Cruz, California, they had the big celebration, which I stupidly missed this year, out in San Lorenzo Park. So I missed all the excitement. At any rate, as it says here, we are excited. We, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, we are excited to announce that on the eve of Earth Day, the Earth Day Network, which works with more than 22,000 partners worldwide, has cut ties with settlement manufacturer SodaStream. SodaStream is the given name, the commercial name, and it does have a lot of other names depending on where and how it's sold. Whichever name suits the bottom line of the almighty buck is a product which you buy for your home, and it takes your tap water and it carbonates it so you can make your own flavored sodas. The kit comes with the machine that does the CO2 mixing and carbonation, and of course the CO2, carbon dioxide, I believe that's the chemical used in the process, and various flavorings. No, I'm not trying to sell you the product, I'm just describing it to you. It is made in an industrial park, which is part of an all-Jewish or Jewish-only Israeli settlement, illegally placed and maintained in occupied Palestinian territory. They are using stolen land, and I make absolutely no apology for using the term stolen here, with water and perhaps other minerals and natural resources which rightfully belong to the Palestinian people. That too is stolen. And the something Edomim, Ma'ela Edomim settlement is where this industrial park lies, cashing in on natural resources, including a lot of water, which is not theirs, belongs to the Palestinians, in order to manufacture this SodaStream product for the home, perhaps for the workplace, etc. However they can market it. It is sold around the world. And in some cases, the packaging improperly, inaccurately, labels the product as made in Israel. It is not made in Israel. It's made in illegal Jewish settlements in Palestine, in what is supposed to be free Palestine. And they have absolutely no agreement with the Palestinian Authority or individual Palestinian farmers or landowners. They just move in, build a settlement, develop an industrial park where they start making this stuff. And they do all of this over the heads of and without the involvement of any Palestinians or Palestinian governmental authority. They do employ a certain number of Palestinian Arabs, non-Jewish Arabs. And there are some really ugly pictures about how these people who are waiting to go to work have to wait in what is literally, there's no exaggeration, no lie here at all. They are kept in a cage. It's like they're in a long line waiting to go to work, waiting to go through an internal checkpoint while they come to work in this Jewish settlement factory. And, of course, out of everyone's security, hint, hint, the Jewish settlers, security of the Jewish settlers there, these Palestinian Arabs wait in this caged line to check in, to go to work, to punch the clock. Sounds like a few situations, vaguely like a few situations I've experienced in my life, but not nearly as bad as what's going on in this industrial park where they make SodaStream. And it's horrific, it's insulting, it's demeaning. And the Israelis slapped themselves on the back and bragged to the world that, oh, we're providing employment to the Palestinians here. They are overworked and underpaid. My sources tell me they're overworked and underpaid, not treated very much like human beings at all. That is the only thing that any Palestinians get out of this, is a little bit of money. I'll bet you bucks to donuts that they're not getting paid as much as their Jewish counterparts in that same industry, in that same activity. So that's what the SodaStream thing is. You've heard me talk about it a lot on previous shows. Continuing with this U.S. campaign to end the occupation, dispatch here. The Earth Day Network has cut ties with settlement manufacturer SodaStream. This victory comes after the U.S. campaign, along with several member groups and others working for Palestinian rights worldwide, mobilized, draw attention to that mighty buck, mobilized in opposition to this partnership due to SodaStream's complicity in Israel's military occupation, including the destruction that Israeli settlements have caused to the Palestinian environment. Entirely pertinent to Earth Day, I would think. The latest BDS win is due to the thousands of people like you who have taken action on SodaStream these past few months. Whether you signed our petition urging Scarlett Johansson, yes, that Scarlett Johansson, to end her relationship with SodaStream. She was like an ambassador for the product. Or you sent out an email to Earth Day Network asking them to drop SodaStream as a sponsor, posted on Facebook and tweeted, or organized protests at stores selling SodaStream. Most of those things I have done. Most, virtually all of them. All these actions have contributed to strengthening our global movement for Palestinian rights. While we celebrate this victory, we know there is a lot more to do for freedom, justice, and equality, and that we need you to accomplish our goal of ending all U.S. support for Israeli occupation and apartheid. Note, they are not talking about complete withdrawal of United States diplomatic recognition or support. They're not talking about kicking Israel out of the United Nations. And they're not talking about, not necessarily talking about ending every last vestige of American corporate complicity or commerce with the Israeli state. Just the recognized extent of BDS boycott, divestment, and sanctions, a cultural and academic boycott, and in this case, directly of a boycott of a product made under clearly illegal circumstances and unnecessary, totally unnecessary. One of the worst vestiges of neocolonialism you can find in the 21st century. To end United States support for the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the, in effect, de facto occupation of the Gaza Strip. Soldiers, even though Jewish settlers are no longer there, soldiers come in and out at will. They really do this on a weekly basis, several times a week. Harassing, firing upon, and sometimes killing unarmed Palestinian farmers and others who are close to the Gaza Strip's border with Israel. And the Israeli military, their so-called defense forces, defending against what? They go in at will and wreak havoc upon the lives of Gazan Palestinians. So just to end the support for that occupation as well. And then they go on to ask me for more support. The U.S. occupation, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation does. I won't deny that that's the gist of this dispatch. Thank you for all you do to strengthen our work for Palestinian rights. Rama Kudaimi, Membership and Outreach Coordinator. And I just wanted to start off on a high note, a victory for BDS. You will hear me talk a lot about BDS. Nobody bothers to call in and challenge my statements or say anything about them, at least not anymore. Once in a great, great, great while, I will get a call from someone either for or again what I'm talking about. You're welcome to call me now. It's 3:23 in the p.m., 3:23 Pacific Daylight Time, Monday, April 21st. Area code 831-427-3772. Just think about calling. Even if you're not, even if you happen to be in agreement with everything I'm talking about, or if you're totally against what I'm talking about, if you have questions, if you have clarifications, feel free to give me a call. That's you, dear caller, dear listener. I take it for granted people do not necessarily want to just sit there and continue to listen to me prattle on all afternoon. Area code 831-427-3772. You may, by the way, also communicate with me, Ren, on the show's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That address incorporates the former name of this program. We are now Mideast Migraines. But the email address is MideastMadness@G as in George, M as in Michael, X as in Xavier.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Be the first on your block, as they say. Another dispatch from the UN News Center. This one about Syria. I think I probably should say something about Syria, even though the program just does lean very heavily on Israeli and Palestinian issues and relationships. Again, from the UN News Center. United Nations cautions Syria against holding presidential election amidst ongoing tragedy. I had almost forgotten that they were talking about holding an election. New York, April 21st, 3 p.m. Urging Syrian authorities. Just checking something here. Again, urging Syrian authorities to reconsider plans to conduct a presidential election. In early June, less than 2 months from now, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and joint UN League of Arab States Special Representative Lakhdar Brahimi today pledged to continue to seek and build on any opportunity to resolve the country's three-year civil war. What else is new, hey? Addressing reporters in New York, Mr. Ban's spokesperson, Stephanie Dujarric, said holding elections in the current circumstances, and I quote, will damage the political process and hamper the prospects for political solution that the country so urgently needs. And when I said Stephanie Dujarric, I believe the name may be Stephane. As she is a he. Presumably been a he all along. He continues to say such elections are incompatible with the letter and spirit of the Geneva communique, he added in reference to the action plan adopted in 2012 during the first international conference on the conflict, calling for a transitional government to lead to free and fair elections. This UN News Center communique goes on. Earlier this year, Mr. Brahimi of the Arab League mediated two rounds of talks between the Syrian government, or what's left of it, and the main opposition group, as there appear to be so many, aimed at finding a political solution to the crisis based on the goals of the communique, but both sides stuck to their positions, and the discussions yielded only modest cooperation on a humanitarian issue related to aid access in the long-besieged old city of Homs. President Bashar al-Assad's government announced that it would hold the poll, the election itself, on 3 June, despite 3 years of fighting between his office and various opposition groups. According to media reports, the Constitutional Court will start accepting nominations for president as early as tomorrow. Let me read that again. According to media reports, the Syria's Constitutional Court will start accepting nominations for president as early as tomorrow. Well, considering that both Bashar Assad and his father, his late father, have had a dynasty in control of Syria for several decades, it would be interesting to see what kind of and how many different individuals will be submitting their applications for nomination for president. Continuing, well over 100,000 people have been killed and an estimated 9 million others driven from their homes. In addition, there are currently more than 2.4 million refugees registered in the region. So in addition to those 9 million Syrians driven from their homes, in addition to that, there are currently more than 2.4 million refugees registered in the region. Some 932,000 in Lebanon, 574,000 in Jordan, some 613,000 in Turkey. No, I guess these are all Syrian refugees, although that definitely includes a high number of longtime Palestinian refugees and their descendants, still legally considered with refugee status, their descendants are, who have become displaced again due to ongoing Mideast turmoil. 223,000 in Iraq, and about 134,000 in Egypt, according to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. Mr. Dujarric said that despite the UN's criticism, Mr. Bon and Mr. Brahimi will, quote, continue to search and build upon any opening for a solution to the tragedy in Syria. Well, not exactly a lot of new news. Something about elections to be held in a few weeks, in some 6-7 weeks in Syria, and the strongly inferred futility of it. Let's find something else a little more appropriate. Okay, I just read about the SodaStream win. Okay, so we'll go to the next item. I had two separate mailings on that. I just wanted to take a quick look. Gag order from Israeli court raises questions. Oh, this is a Twitter. I hate it when I think I'm going to get a nice, juicy article, and it just turns out to be a tiny tweet. New York Times public editor finds it, quote, troubling that the Times is waiting for government clearance before deciding to publish. Well, let's see if I can chart new nothing. I think people out there are guessing correctly, of course, that I don't do a lot of tweets. I don't even really have a decent idea of what it's about. Here is something, though, that I threw together just last night in readable form. The Israeli legal system reflects general injustice. Forwarded to me by my friend David Schermerhorn. There was no picture included, but there's a caption to an unseen picture, unseen not only by you, but by me. In this Sunday, November 3rd, 2013 photo, a Palestinian boy walks around his home in the village of Beit Umar near the West Bank city of Hebron. At the age of 15, the boy was held for 9 months in an Israeli military jail for throwing rocks at passing Israeli cars near his village in the West Bank. An Israeli 15-year-old boy was arrested for a similar crime at the same time but faced a different justice system. The Israeli boy refused to allow his photo to be taken. That's what that's about anyway. This is Associated Press writer Mohammed Darakhmeh in Ramallah, West Bank, contributed to this report. An AP writer from Beit Umar, West Bank, Associated Press. The boys were both 15. And the crackly voices and awkward peach fuzz, with the crackly voices and awkward peach fuzz of adolescents, 15-year-olds, they lived just a few minutes away from one another in the West Bank. And both were accused of throwing stones at vehicles one day after the other. But there was a crucial difference that helped to shape each boy's fate. One was Israeli and the other Palestinian. The tale of the two teens provides a stark example of the vast disparities of Israel's justice system in the West Bank, a contested area at the heart of the elusive search for a lasting peace. While Israeli settlers in the West Bank fall mostly under civilian rule, Jewish-Israeli settlers do, non-Jewish Palestinians are subject to Israeli military law. Israeli and Palestinian youths face inequities at every stage in the path of justice, from arrests to convictions and sentencing, according to police statistics, folks. According to statistics obtained by the Associated Press through multiple requests under Israel's Freedom of Information law. The results can ripple for years. Jail destroyed his life, said the Palestinian boy's father. Whoops. Still here. Only 53 Israeli settler youths were arrested for stone throwing. Folks, listen to these statistics. Only 53 Israeli settler youths were arrested for stone throwing over the past 6 years, the data shows, and 89% of those were released without charge. 89%. Six were indicted. Four of those were found, quote, guilty without conviction, a common sentence for Israeli juveniles that aims not to stain their record, you know, as youths. One was cleared. The sixth case was still in court as of October of last year, the most recent information available. Okay, now listen, by contrast, compared to 53 Israeli settler youths, 1,142 Palestinian youths were arrested by police over the same period for throwing stones. And of that 1,142, 528 were indicted. Close to half. All of the indicted were convicted. Lawyers say the penalty is typically 3 to 8 months in military prison. Israel's justice minister said more than five Israeli stone throwers were indicted in the past 6 years, but declined to provide examples. Itzhak Baum, a lawyer who represents Israeli settler youths, said he knew of 20 Israeli minors in the West Bank indicted for stone throwing in recent years, including six who pleaded guilty and six who were cleared. He said the other cases are still in court. The police numbers are not comprehensive because the Israeli army also arrests Palestinian youths. Up to now, we were talking about regular Israeli police in the occupied territories. But the police numbers were not comprehensive because the Israeli army also arrests Palestinian youths and because the state prosecutor also issues indictments against settlers in more serious cases. However, the gap between the numbers for Israelis and Palestinians is clear and wide. Israel's justice minister said the numbers reflect the fact that Palestinians threw more stones than Israelis, rather than unequal treatment. Quote, though the legal systems are different, military court versus civil court, the relevant law is implied impartially, said Yehuda Shefer, a deputy state prosecutor who is head of a Justice Ministry Committee for West Bank Law Enforcement. Not to make too fine a point of it, and not to insult anyone's intelligence, but I will remind everyone we are talking about life for stateless, disenfranchised, familiar words to you all, Palestinians under military control, and they have been for the past, 46 years, 47 years, since 1967. Peace process has brought nothing of any real improvement in the lives of these stateless Arabs. We're talking about Israeli-occupied territory, supposedly being held on to for the sake of the security of the Israeli people. Returning now to this article. The Israeli Justice Ministry says it would like to rehabilitate Palestinian youth, but ends up jailing many offenders because their parents and leaders support their crimes. However, critics accuse Israel of dismissing Israeli crimes as youthful indiscretions while treating Palestinian youths like hardened criminals. I'm going to read that again. However, critics of the system accuse Israel of dismissing Israeli crimes as youthful indiscretions while treating Palestinian youths as hardened criminals. Quote, everyone knows there is a problem with the treatment of minors in the West Bank, a systematic discrimination between Israeli minors and Palestinian minors, said Michael Sfard, an Israeli attorney and a Palestinian human rights defender. Now you have the figures to prove that. Continuing with this article, written to some extent by Associated Press writer Mohammed Daragmeh in Ramallah, West Bank. Stones become an iconic weapon in the West Bank, an arid land where the stones, are plentiful. In the past 6 years, more than half of all arrests of Palestinian youth have been over stone throwing, which Israel claims can be the first step towards militancy. Extremist Israeli settlers have also adopted the tactic. On February 20, 2012, 2 years ago, the Israeli boy joined a group of youths pelting a bus with rocks at the entrance to Bat Ayin, according to police reports. The settlement, Jewish settlement, located in the southern West Bank between Jerusalem and the biblical city of Hebron, is known for its hardline population, meaning, of course, the Jews. Police said they targeted the bus because the driver was Arab. The rocks damaged the bus, but did not harm the driver. The boy, whose name cannot be published under local law because he is a minor, was brought to the Hebron Regional Police Station at 9 o'clock at night with his father by his side. At his interrogation, the boy invoked his right to remain silent. He spent a night in the station and 4 days under house arrest. Then he was freed without charge. The following day, according to police reports, the Palestinian boy lobbed rocks at Israeli cars zipping past his hometown of Beit Umar, a farming town of 14,000 people perched near an Israeli military tower. Police said he and others wanted to show solidarity with a high-profile Palestinian prisoner on hunger strike in an Israeli jail. The police admitted that. The rock shattered the front windshield of a white Mazda and damaged three other vehicles on a busy highway. There were no injuries. The incident was caught on tape and broadcast on Israeli evening news. Can you see where this is going now? 2 weeks later, at 3:30 in the morning, 3:30 a.m., Israeli soldiers kicked down the door to the Palestinian boy's bedroom, carried him to a jeep, blindfolded him, and tied his hands behind his back with plastic handcuffs, he said. He was slapped by soldiers, kept awake all night, and placed in a military jail cell with 10 other Palestinian youths, he said. It would be more than 9 months before he could go free. And as a moment ago when I said, you see where this is going? Well, indeed, you see, you know, you takes certain basic incidents reported film it, broadcast it on Israeli evening news. You let the media have that impact on the general civilian public. And hence, voila, 2 weeks later at 3:30 a.m., Israeli soldiers kicked down the door to the boy's bedroom, carried him to a jeep, blindfolded him, and tied him, etc., stripped him. He was slapped by soldiers. All this apparently in the wake of pressure coming from the frightened Israeli public that demands something be done about this horrific crime. That's what I was talking about when I said, do you see where this is going? All right. Continuing with article, an Israeli psychological exam conducted in prison found the boy showed signs of anxiety and depression. He told the prison's clinical psychologist and social worker that he looked at a photo of his family to help him sleep and had nightmares about soldiers killing his relatives. The exam also found he was short-breathed and had a cough, which he said was from soldiers hitting him in the chest during his arrest. The West Bank, an expanse of rocky hilltops blanketed in olive trees, is central to the current round of U.S. brokered peace talks. For Palestinians, the West Bank is the heart of a future state along with adjacent East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. For Israel, the land known by its biblical name of Judea and Samaria is significant to Jewish heritage and to security, it says here. Since Israel captured the West Bank in 1967, it has built more than 100 settlements, creating, quote-unquote, facts on the ground that complicate any future withdrawal. Some 60% of the West Bank is under full Israeli control. I had a guy argue with me. I converse via the internet with by way of these various chat rooms and comment sections for other articles and media, including video presentations. And one of these clowns is trying to tell me, it's not that bad. The Jews only have... their Jewish settlements only cover no more than 5 or 6% of the West Bank. Well, if you're talking about Jewish settlements per se, the amount of land that the settlement buildings and adjacent properties, presumably, cover is 5 or 6%. Less than 1 out of 20 parcels of land in the West Bank, right? It's far more complicated than that, I told him, and I spelled it out. I don't have that particular correspondence in front of me, but as it says in this article, some 60%, three-fifths, well over half, 60% of the West Bank is under full Israeli control. Continuing with the article, once again, today more than 350,000 Israeli settlers live in the West Bank amid roughly 2.5 million Palestinians. The two sides have little interaction and for the most part live under separate and often unequal systems of law. While the Palestinian Authority governs day-to-day affairs, the Israeli military wields overall control. Palestinians need Israeli permission to enter Israel or to travel abroad through the Jordanian border. Now think about that. Starting in the west, you have the Mediterranean Sea, and then moving east, you have the State of Israel. And then you have the occupied Palestinian West Bank. And then continuing east, then you have the independent nation of Jordan, or the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Kingdom or not, it's still an independent country. That puts the West Bank, what is supposed to be the Free State of Palestine, smack between the State of Israel, or at least the middle part of Israel, and the country of Jordan. But the Palestinians still need Israeli permission to travel abroad to leave the West Bank if they go through Jordan. Why is that, I wonder? Continuing, Palestinians frequently suffer from poor roads, creaky infrastructure, and, I'll insert here, most notably, water shortages. Israeli settlers, by contrast, are Israeli citizens. I'll say it again. Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank, illegally by international law, are, by contrast, Israeli citizens, as though they live in the behind-the-green-lines Jewish state of Israel. It says here, they are subject to Israeli law, vote in Israeli elections, move freely in and out of Israel, and have access to Israel's modern infrastructure. They serve in and are protected by the Israeli army. Israel says that extending its laws to Palestinians would be tantamount to annexation, and that many of the restrictions, such as military checkpoints, are needed for security. Paul Herson, a spokesman for the Israeli Foreign Military, said Israel tries to help the Palestinians, but acknowledged the setup is problematic. We're stuck in this interim status, and it's not good, he said. This is precisely the reason we need to resolve this thing through negotiations. Again, that was a quote from Paul Herson's spokesman for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Israel's Ministry of Justice says it attaches, quote-unquote, great importance to narrowing the differences in the law regarding juvenile detainees. In 2009, Israel created a juvenile military court. In other words, a military court handling the cases of juvenile delinquents. In 2011, it raised the age of minority. The age of minority for Palestinian youth from 16 to 18. I'm not sure what that means, age of minority. If anyone wants to clarify that for me, call in at 831-427-3772. In 2011, Israel raised the age of minority for Palestinian youth to 16 to 18. I would suspect what they mean is it raised the age to 18 of minor. Oh, minority. Okay, minor minority. In 2011, it raised the age of minority, or being a minor, for Palestinian youth from 16 to 18. And in 2013, it shortened the amount of time a West Bank Palestinian minor can be held under detention from 8 days to, in most cases, 1 or 2 days. Still double the time allowed for an Israeli minor. In our perspective, a minor is a minor, the Justice Ministry said in a statement. The Israeli boy's journey through the justice system was one of repeated second chances. The middle child of a psychologist mother and a psychiatrist father, he lived and studied at a religious school in Batayin, a rural community of about 200 families. After his release from jail, the case remained closed until he was arrested again. This time, he was accused of attacking two Palestinians with pepper spray while in possession of a knife and a slingshot decorated with the words, "Revenge on Arabs." Again, this is the Israeli boy they're talking about. Accused of attacking two Palestinians with pepper spray while in possession of a knife and a slingshot decorated with the words, "Revenge on Arabs." During a court hearing on the pepper spray charge, prosecutors brought up his previous rock-throwing arrest. Only then was he indicted for both offenses. The Israeli minor pleaded guilty to pepper spraying but denied throwing rocks. He was put under house arrest, meaning arrest in his own house, his own home, with his parents, his family, for 9 months. While at home, he prepared for Israeli national matriculation exams. During the final 3 months, he was permitted to attend school. Then he was freed. It was nearly 2 years after the alleged stone-throwing incident that he finally stood trial, which is ongoing. There was no such leniency for the Palestinian boy. The youngest of four brothers, he grew up in a modest cement home surrounded by bougainvillea plants and verdant farm lands. He liked to play basketball. His lawyer would only permit the Associated Press to identify him by his first name, Zane. Zane's father, a short man with a cigarette perched between his mustache. Zane's father, a short man with a cigarette perched under his mustache and a forehead carved with lines, described the boy as a B-plus student who could have gone on to a professional career. This is the Palestinian boy. That all changed after his arrest. While many Palestinian prisoners accept plea bargains in exchange for reduced imprisonment, the boy pleaded innocent and went to trial. After 9.5 months in prison, he was put under house arrest. 7 months in house arrest following 9.5 months in prison, he was convicted and sentenced to time already served. Well, thank goodness for that. In the ruling, the judge criticized the police interrogator for not asking the boy if he understood his rights and not giving him the opportunity to consult with his lawyer or parents. Quote, "It appears from the interrogation in this case that the Israeli police do not understand the sensitivity obligated in interrogating juvenile suspects," military judge Shahar Greenberg wrote. Requests for response from the Israeli police were not answered. In the end, the Israeli and the Palestinian teens had one thing in common. Despite Israel's stated goals, neither was rehabilitated. Instead, both were embraced by communities that condone stone throwing. After his release from house arrest, the Israeli boy joined an extremist group known as the Hilltop Youth and moved to an unauthorized settlement outpost called Hill 904. These defiant, ideological Jewish teens squat on West Bank hilltops and attack Palestinians and their property. There was a big celebration when he arrived, the boy said. He built makeshift homes on the hill for 6 months and studied Jewish law with his comrades. Then he moved to another outpost, and another, and another. He still denies throwing rocks, but said it was an acceptable tactic to fight Palestinians, citing a teaching by an extremist rabbi. He described himself as a warrior in an ideological battle for Jewish control of the West Bank. Wherever soldiers are needed, I go, he mumbled outside the courtroom after a recent hearing. He wore the settler youth uniform of long side locks and tattered cargo pants with a few chin hairs of adolescence. We're commanded to inherit the land and to expel Palestinians. End quote. When the Palestinian boy got out of jail, he rejoined his 10th grade class at the end of the school year, but couldn't catch up and dropped out. For a while, he tried to sell knockoff shoes hoarded in his bedroom. Now he mopes around his parents' house, not doing much of anything. My school wanted me to go back to classes, but I quit, he said with a shrug, sitting in his parents' living room in sandals with greased hair. His lawyer, Neri Ramadi, is appealing the conviction while prosecutors are seeking a tougher sentence of 6 more months in jail. His father, Hisham, said Palestinians have every right to throw stones to achieve independence. He said he and two other sons were all arrested by Israel when they threw stones, unlike his youngest son, who claims innocence. His father's conclusion, quote, he's a coward. So indeed we have two societies where stone throwing is encouraged for the Palestinians to achieve independence, since the PIECE peace process is going nowhere for them, does nothing to improve the lives of Palestinian Arabs in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip still being in de facto the internationally recognized form of occupation, even in the absence of Jewish settlers. The Israeli boys, the Israeli youth, on the other hand, do this because they are compelled, in this particular case, by the teachings of an extremist rabbi, to expel Palestinians so they can claim the land. You see, if my way of looking at this, of course, is that the Palestinians had the rights to the land, not only because everyone who quotes responsible legal terminology from around the world, according to international law, will tell you that it is Palestinian Arab land, not Israeli land, not Jewish land, not by right. And that the Israelis, even though they have a heritage dating back well over 2,000 years, is just that, it's history. Regardless of the genes and chromosomes, which may or may not be involved, by present-day Jews, followers of, to some degree or another, of Judaic tradition, be it ancient, revised, what's that other word beside revised? You know. Modern-day reinterpretation of Judaic value. Despite all of those traditions and tendencies, it's one thing to claim that you have a heritage, a historical heritage based on land, and quite another to use that history exclusively as total justification for ethnic cleansing of non-Jewish people so the Jews can take it over again. That just doesn't jive with me. It doesn't jive with a lot of people, including a great, great, great many Jews who, interestingly, have their own unique history over the past more than 100 years, really, of disowning this notion of once again redeeming the land according to Scripture, according to some Jews' idea of God's commandments. these breakaway Jews have long maintained that a Zionist or reclamation of a Jewish homeland, Jews, that Zionism is not compatible with the essence of real Judaic value. One does not necessarily support the other. Okay, I do not want to get into a long bout of discussing with myself, arguing with myself about these different takes on Jewish tradition and Jewish ethics. Let's see. Aha. Okay, we're going to have a musical break now because I need to do some important things. You may or may not call in. If I do not answer, it's only because I took a short 2-minute potty break. But I'll be back after the music, and this, of course, is some oud music in the Greek manner played by Mavrothi T. Kontanis. Oud music. The Arabic lute. The predecessor to the European lute.
Εσένα κλαίγω
Steve. Thank you.
Old Ren was taking care of a little bit of personal business there. So you got a rendition of 2 1/2 full Greek oud songs, music played on the oud in the Greek manner. It's 4:16 Pacific Daylight Time. You're listening to Ren's very own Mideast Migraine Show, emanating from Free Radio Santa Cruz. Must have a piece of food between my teeth. I perceive a slight whistling into the microphone. Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and of course on our online radio service at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Don't forget, you have the option of sending an essentially one-way message to me via this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Just shoot me over a line to say hi. Or whatever you are truly inclined to say. You can also call me here. We've got more than a half hour left of this program. Area code 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. I also want to remind everyone that these shows are recorded for posterior's posterity. Or posterity's posterior. Little joke there. I know, very little. And you may find the archives of these recorded episodes at another website altogether, radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the numerical character 4. So you've got radio, the number 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. Search for Mideast Migraines or Mideast Madness programs there. And you may download them to listen at your own convenience, wherever and whenever you like. And that's assuming you have the proper equipment to do so. Where did I put my glasses? All right, somebody out there tell me where I... Never mind, I found them. With all these wires and microphone bases and things... Things can get lost. Ha-ha. Yeah, there. See, I just successfully downloaded last Saturday's program. Saturday editions of Mideast Madness, which come to you every Saturday starting at 11 a.m. for a couple of hours. 11 o'clock in the morning every Saturday are currently dedicated to finishing that book that I started last November. I'm actually reading an entire book on the air, although we're almost done with it, in case this is the first you've heard about it. It is written by Mr. Max Blumenthal, entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. I completed chapter 66, and there are only 73 chapters in the book, but tune in anyway. We're getting to the climax. That's every Saturday, readings from books pertaining to the matter of Israel and Palestine and Palestine and Israel and all that. Yeah, I've just downloaded that one for your listening and viewing pleasure. Okay. And, of course, I'll have to redirect those details to another alternate archive somewhere. Okay, I'm just checking things out, taking care of business. Happy to have you all listening to this program, including the ones that I can detect on our... Including the ones that I have here on our magical detection device. Question... Oh! That earlier item, gag order from Israeli court, raises questions. It just popped up, or I finally had access to it. What's that one all about? This is from the New York Times, April 18. That's last Friday. By Margaret Sullivan, gag order from Israeli court raises questions. You see, this is what happens when you are patient with your little home pewters there. The opinion pages, Public Editor's Journal, Margaret Sullivan, April 18. The Times, this would be the New York Times, published an article Thursday afternoon about an Arab citizen of Israel, a 23-year-old journalist and Palestinian rights advocate who was detained by Israeli authorities last week. Mind you, now we're talking about a person who is not a Jew, but is a citizen of Israel. They call them Arab citizens of Israel or Israeli Arabs. They are, of course, Palestinian Israelis, in my book, by my way of looking at it. We're not talking about Arabs in the occupied territories. This is a supposedly quote-unquote, full-fledged rights Israeli citizen enjoying the lovely advertised parodies, equalnesses of Israeli life here. This is in Israel. Okay, back to the article. Starting, The Times published an article Thursday afternoon about an Arab citizen of Israel, a 23-year-old journalist and Palestinian rights advocate who was detained by Israeli authorities last weekend. The man, Majd Khayal, was not allowed a lawyer until Wednesday night, and he was interrogated for 5 days on suspicion that he was being recruited by a, quote, hostile organization after he visited Lebanon. On suspicion that he was being recruited by them. He was released on Thursday, but ordered to be kept under house arrest. The Times article mentions the court-imposed gag order that was lifted on Thursday. What it doesn't mention is that the Times, too, is subject to such gag orders. According to its bureau chief in Jerusalem, Jody Redoran, that is true. The Times is, and I quote, indeed bound by gag orders, Ms. Redoran said. She said that the situation is analogous to abiding by traffic rules or any other laws of the land, and that two of her predecessors in the bureau chief position affirmed to her this week that the Times has been subject to gag orders in the past. And then in parentheses it says here, an earlier version of this post said that the Times agrees to abide by gag orders as a prerequisite for press credentials, but Ms. Redoran told me today that that is not the case, although it was her initial understanding. Closed parentheses. I asked the Times newsroom lawyer, David McCraw, about the situation. He told me that he was consulted by Times journalists this week as they are considered publishing an article about Mr. Khayal's arrest. Although the situation is somewhat murky, he said, and I quote here, quote, the general understanding among legal counsel in other countries is that local law would apply to foreign media, end quote. Similar issues arise when America news media organizations cover the British courts, he said. But the restriction in Israel has not been tested, he said. I've never seen us actually challenge it, Mr. McCross said, because no situation has arisen that would force the issue. Two ranking editors at the Times, the managing editor Dean Baquette and an assistant managing editor Susan Shira, who was the foreign editor for 8 years, told me that they were unaware of the Times ever agreeing to abide by gag orders in Israel. Meanwhile, an online publication called The Electronic Intifada published a number of articles about Mr. Khayal's detention over the past several days. The author of those two articles, Ali Abunima, said in an email that, quote, readers have a right to know when NYT, the New York Times, is complying with government-imposed censorship, end quote. And Yusuf Munir, executive director of the Jerusalem Fund and the Palestine Center, wrote to me that this seems to go against journalistic principles. Namely, and I quote, it would seem to me that a story that a state specifically wants to prevent us from seeing the light of day is something that would make a journalist's mouth water. That's what journalism is about, isn't it? End quote. If there had been a major story and a long-standing gag order, Ms. Ruderin said she is convinced that the Times would find a way to publish, despite the legal restriction. That would take the form of writing a story from New York or Washington rather than from Israel. And in parentheses, this story from 2010, which was published without a byline or a dateline indicating where it was written, appears to be an example of that. In the case of Thursday's article about Mr. Kyle, Ms. Redoran said, "We probably would have written a modest story or a brief about this arrest earlier if there had not been a gag order. Waiting a day or two until the gag order was lifted may have done no great harm. Still, I find it troubling that the Times is in the position of waiting for government clearance before deciding to publish. If the law makes that situation unavoidable, a little transparency would go a long way. Either in a sentence, within an article, or a short editor's note, the Times can and should tell its readers what's going on. The foreign editor, Joseph Kahn, told me that he was not involved in the editing of this article, but that in general he agreed with the idea of keeping Times readers informed in that way. It makes sense to do that, he said. And again, that article was written by Ms. Margaret Sullivan of the NYT's opinion pages, specifically the section entitled Public Editor's Journal. Public Editor Margaret Sullivan's Journal. Lots of space underneath that article, but no other R comments. 46 comments. I guess I have to go to a special section for that. Let's read these comments from internet readers, shall we? Let's do it. Westsider says, "I have seen Israeli press quote foreign papers at times to get around Israeli gag orders. I have seen Israeli press quote foreign papers at times to get around Israeli gag orders. Stories about prisoner X in Israel were examples of such. Therefore, it seems unlikely NYT is actually bound by Israeli gag orders. It may be a self-imposed restriction by NYT and rooted in perhaps feeling a bit Israeli and all." It's, oh, okay. Yeah. Whoops. Please don't do that. Okay. Alex says, "Thanks, Mrs. Sullivan, for bringing this up. A few months ago, I remember that a Guardian article was mentioning links between the NSA, that's the American National Security Agency that spies on us, you know. Links between NSA and Israel Secret Services was not reported by the NYT. If I remember correctly, this situation has also led to your intervention. It seems that the Times editorial team is not as brave as the Guardians or the Washington Posts. Something concerning for the Times in the mid or long term. Look at what the Wall Street Journal has become," whatever that means. Bob Garcia, "What if the NY Times had a gag order status page that told readers when gag orders were in effect in various countries and the topics being gagged? Whoa. Yeah, how about totally formalizing a situation, alerting everyone to the degree to which sources are being censored, and that certain information is being censored? How ironic, how bass-ackwards is that, right?" Bruce says, "There was a high number," check that. Bruce says, "There was a high-profile murder trial in Ontario, just across the border from upstate New York about 20 years ago. The Americans actually decided it should be covered. However, they broke Canadian law by publishing details in their papers and perhaps radio, TV, though I'm not 100% sure, not allowed in the Canadian media. They were told that they would not be allowed into the courtroom if they continued to do so." Brian says, "Here's the basic issue. Via electronic intifada. Adalah." Now, when he says Adalah, I believe he's referring to the organization inside Israel which addresses, researches, and brings light to the public issues concerning Arab rights in Israel. Adala places the persecution of Kayal in the context of Israel's broader repressive measures, specifically targeting Palestinian citizens of Israel. In Adala's view, the core issue is the prohibition on Palestinian citizens of Israel from entering numerous Arab countries, which in this case prevents journalists like Kayal from enjoying their right to work, communicate, and be in physical contact with Arab journalists and Arab language newspapers. By contrast, Israeli media, and apparently the authorities, consider it a major achievement when Israeli Jewish journalists enter Arab countries, perhaps considering this as a sign of normalization of ties or national prowess. There have been several recent instances of Jewish Israeli journalists, quote, sneaking into Syria with no reported negative consequences. In another instance, in 2007, Lisa Goldman, a Canadian who settled in present-day Israel, traveled to Lebanon to file reports for Israel's Channel 10. Goldman, accused of breaching journalistic ethics, told CNN she was driven by, quote-unquote, pure curiosity. Goldman, who now works for the New America Foundation, is also not known to have been detained incommunicado, interrogated, banned from meeting with lawyers, nor to have suffered any other negative consequences. I'm going to read a few more of these reader comments. I hope this stuff is not too highbrow, too unapproachable for you listeners out there. Annette B., let every article subject to a gag order state it somewhere in the text. State the fact that it is a gag order somewhere in the text. All countries who force such bargains should have this policy stated when it applies. This should be the newspaper's policy. The presence of the gag order should be known. Readers can then judge. At the very least, I think people should be aware of the existence of gag orders and how they work. Alex says, I thank much, he says, I very much thank Ms. Sullivan for this column. Gag orders, like other forms of censorship, are anathema to a free press. There are legitimate reasons for gag orders and other forms of censorship. A classic example is forbidding publication of troop movements in times of conflict. But acceptable rationales for gag orders are few and far between. And the worst forms of government censorship and gag orders are those the public is not allowed to be told exist. Let me read that to you again. Wrap your mind around this. And the worst forms of government censorship and gag orders are those the public is not allowed even to be told exist. Dun, 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 dun. Israel has many legitimate reasons to be concerned about its security, but they may overdo it with censorship. For example, thanks to Israeli lobbying, it is illegal under United States law for a company to publish good quality satellite images of any part of Israel. Try entering Tel Aviv in the Google Maps, it says here. Thanks to Israeli lobbying, illegal for under U.S. law for a company to publish good quality satellite images of any part of Israel, or for that matter, Dimona, hey, where the Israel keeps all of its atomic energy and atomic bomb accoutrements. Continuing with this letter, the Times needs to conform to local laws. But for a news organization, there is a world of difference between following traffic laws and obeying mandates for censorship. In general, the Times should apply the same policies towards censorship to friendly nations like Israel that it does to, say, China. And the Times must be as transparent as it possibly can about its policies towards gag orders and censorship policies in general, as well as to specific episodes such as this. Again, I thank the public editor for shining light on this very important topic. Ralph says, let me grab some water here.
I don't want my voice to just poop out on you. Oh, that helps. Grab my first throat spray of the afternoon as well. And that helps.
Ralph says, Ralph of Chicago, Illinois, what this article fails to mention is that Israel is a democracy in a state of war. Yes, Israel has peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan, but it is still in a state of war with Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and just about every country in the Middle East going back decades. This Israeli citizen deliberately and knowingly violated Israeli law and traveled to a country that is at war with Israel, Lebanon, namely, and dominated by a militia-slash-terrorist-group-slash-social organization, Hezbollah, dedicated to Israel's destruction. When the U.S. was in a state of war with Germany and Japan, how do you think the U.S. would have dealt with one of its citizens traveling to those countries? How did the U.S. deal with press censorship when it was in a state of war? If you're going to criticize Israel, at least get all the facts out there and get the right context and frame of reference. True. I believe this. The author here, Ralph, knows what he or she is talking about. But as you can guess, I always bristle when I read such defenses of Israel and how they can get around activities of a normal nation because they're in a state of war, because their security and very existence is threatened, blah, blah, blah. I remind everyone, all my listeners, that Israel, the ball is in Israel's court, and it has been since 1948, since 1956, 1967, 82. These are the wars of the aforementioned years were the years in which wars took place between Israel and somebody else. Almost all of them started by Israel. And what I mean by the ball is in Israel's court is their application of freedoms, human, civil, and political rights to those under their iron grip, and to Israeli non-Jewish citizens, the application of those laws is in their hands. It's an ongoing circular form of circular reasoning when you say, well, Israel cannot lift all the gag orders because they had their own security in mind. But then Israel goes on denying basic human rights to those under its wing, as it were, which raises more animosity among neighboring Arab states, and thereby the state of war perpetuates. So that's what I feel about that. Yes, Ralph, we should get all the facts out there and get the right context and frame of reference. Peter Feld of New York. Quote, waiting a day or two until the gag order was lifted may have done no great harm, end quote. Not true. It prevented calling attention to the situation of a journalist held incommunicado while it was underway. Of course, the Times routinely ignores these stories, so it's questionable whether it would have published this news earlier even without a gag order. Michael Hoffman of the Pacific Northwest writes, did the Electronic Intifada website force your hand, or would the Times' compliance with the gag order have been revealed anyway? I'll do one more here. William McGowan, NYC. What I find odd about this story is that when the Times did go with it, After the gag order was rescinded, it was written by a Bureau reporter, Isabel Kirshner, not Redoran. Kirshner is an Israeli citizen. She's also married to a member of a right-wing think tank in Israel with close ties to the Likud party, which is the party in control of the government there in Israel. And her marriage has already been the subject of complaints at the paper about conflicts of interest, which Sullivan herself addressed and dismissed 2 months ago. Who was actually sitting on the story, Kirshner or Udorin? We're getting, folks, I know this stuff is maybe eye-rolling to the listener or just makes you yawn and fall asleep, but that we're getting into the inner workings of the American and extra-American media reporting business here. This is real, some of this stuff is really getting to the background of what we see on the headlines. The article, let's see, William McGowan's letter concludes, back in the bad old days at the Times, Jews were not posted to Israel because the paper's editors thought it might present a conflict of interest or an appearance of one. Some were upset, feeling that the policy offended their journalistic professionalism and detachment. They had a right to be, and it's good the paper has changed its mind. But what about having an Israeli citizen in the bureau with Kirshner's marital connection, especially at a time when censorship in Israel grows more draconian under pressure from hardcore Zionists? Okay. No more about this item. Let's move along again here. Keep moving along. And in order to do that, I guess I'll need to get... Mommy, I'm going to have to dismiss this whole window here. Clicking back goes nowhere. Aha, there it is. Looking for it. It's 4:45 in the p.m., by the way, 4:45 in the afternoon, 4,500 hours Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of North America. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren, your friendly neighborhood Palestinian-American, coming to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 on the FM dial here in the city of Santa Cruz. And to everyone else on the globe, above the globe, maybe underneath the earth, on our online radio service at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Click on that red oval to get the link. Oh, here it is. I just didn't look down far enough. Getting away from Israeli-Palestinian relationships for the moment, our old friend, cough, cough, Rush Limbaugh, is in ruins. According to this piece from the Daily Kos, they have some terrific, often rather casual pieces that come across. Rush Limbaugh is in ruins. There's a video that I may play for you. But first, let's get to the essential article, Friday, April 18. Rush Limbaugh is in ruins. Bad news coming from every direction, including the right. It's been a very bad week for talk show host Rush Limbaugh, and a very rewarding week for the millions of Americans who have protested his extreme hate speech for decades. 2 years ago, newer groups like Boycott Rush, Flush Rush, Stop Rush, apparently that is one organization there, began a massive national boycott movement that is exposing Limbaugh and crushing his career. Well, according to this article anyway, here are four new recent developments. One, Politico published an article revealing that Tea Party organizations Some, created by the Koch brothers, have contributed millions to Rush Limbaugh. What does this mean? For Rush, it means they help sustain him while thousands of sponsors... That's right, thousands of sponsors pulled their ads. It means this may lead to an investigation to see if the funding was done legally. According to the Federal Communications Commission, if you receive money from an organization that pays you to promote their propaganda without telling your audience, it may be considered, quote, payola, and it may be illegal. And here is, under that item number one, here's a quote from Politico. The Heritage Foundation at the end of January ended its 5-year sponsorship of El Rushbo's show, for which it had paid more than $2 million in some years and more than $9.5 million overall. In 2012, FreedomWorks paid at least $1.4 million to make him an endorser, though it's not clear that the sponsorship is ongoing, end quote. Number two, Forbes, the numbered items here are four new recent developments as stated by this Daily Kos article. That was number one. Number two, Forbes senior political contributor and regular on Forbes on Fox. Accidentally hit the wrong nut button on my keyboard with the wrong finger. I'll start over. Number two, Forbes senior political contributor and regular on Forbes on Fox, Rick Unger, believes Rush Limbaugh has become a joke. He also shows via frontpagemag.com data that Limbaugh has outlived his audience. Unger, also known as Forbes' token lefty, implies Rush is now in the toss-out-the-old, bring-in-the-new demographic category. The median age of his dwindling audience, as well as the aforementioned sponsor boycott. Let's read that again. I need to make sure I understand what I'm reading, not just you. The median age of his dwindling audience, as well as the aforementioned sponsor boycott, no longer appeals to advertisers. Quote from Rick Unger. At long last, it appears that Rush Limbaugh has run out of steam. I have to acknowledge that I have sensed Rush getting by on fumes for some time now. Yes, I tune into his show from time to time to enjoy his broadcasting skills, if not his message. However, it was only recently that the world of Limbaugh crossed that thin red line from partially serious to total self-parody. And audience deception, a line crossed from which there is often no return. And a quotation from frontpagemag.com, network television doesn't just fail to count older viewers, it tries to drive them away. A show of an older viewership is dead air. Advertisers have been pushed by ad agencies into an obsession with associating their project with a youthful brand. The demo rating, 18 to 49, is the only rating that matters. Viewers younger than that can still pay off. Just ask the CW, referring to CW Television Network. Older viewers, however, are unwanted. Third recent development, number three. Speaking of advertisers, Rush Limbaugh can't seem to hold on to them without doling out heavy discounts and or free ad space. After his notorious on-air verbal attack of then-unknown Sandra Fluke, the national protests was sent in motion. Hard-working Flush Rush volunteers now monitor the Rush Limbaugh show nationwide. They document the sponsor ads they hear on his show into the Stop Rush database, along with contact and ad details. The sponsor data is then posted back into the Flush Rush private Facebook group and onto the Boycott Rush Facebook page for public use. There have been hundreds of articles written about Rush Limbaugh and the boycotts against him that have appeared in at least a dozen political online news groups, including Liberals Unite and Daily Kos, and have been viewed by millions. The result? Limbaugh and the radio stations that carry him have lost millions in ad revenue. Very few took the Limbaugh boycott seriously 2 years ago. It reminds me of the Gandhi quote, Mahatma Gandhi, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win." Quote, unquote. I like that a lot. Quite universal application there. And latest development number 4. And lastly, Ed Schultz interviewed Holland Cook this weekend. Interviewed Holland Cook this week. Cook believes Limbaugh's business is over for good due to the various organized boycotts mentioned above. Each does its own part. The protests have been supported by many big and small liberal organizations, websites, Facebook pages, groups, and Twitter. Quotation by Holland Cook via the Daily Kos. And a reminder, Daily Kos is where this whole article is appearing. Holland Cook says, quote, "Hundreds of blue-chip national advertisers basically have not only wandered away from Rush Limbaugh and some of the other righties, they've abandoned the format entirely. They are afraid to be heard on a news talk station because this man's use of his free speech triggered the opposing viewpoint exercising their right to free speech. The boycotters are speaking and using the marketplace to say enough," end quote. Okay, now, and then they mentioned, and then this article mentions the audio clip of the Ed Schultz Holland Cook interview. Forgo that for now. So now, it says here, so now, we're not only hearing from consumers, we're hearing from industry experts on the left and right, many of whom know the business better than anyone and would not risk their reputations on mere gossip. Yes, yes, the public has had enough. Limbaugh's self-proclaimed ditto heads slash fans demanded that Limbaugh's right to free speech also gives him the right to spew misogyny, homophobia, bigotry, and racism on public radio. Clarification from Wren here. When they say public radio, they're not referring to national public radio. Small p, small r. Referring to his Limbaugh's supposed rights to spew misogyny, homophobia, bigotry, and racism on radio that's heard to the public ear. That's what they mean here. Continuing with the article. He's been getting away with it for over 25 years. After the Sandra Fluke attack, the general public soon realized that neither his radio affiliates nor the FCC plans to do anything about his hate speech, so American consumers decided to use their own version of free speech via petitions, boycotts, and their consumer dollars to bring Limbaugh down by way of his sponsors. Sounds a lot to me like the same philosophy behind BDS to bring down Israel's lack of cooperation in administering and permitting parity amongst all its citizens, non-Jew and Jew alike. Same kind of thing as what I was saying about BDS. Continuing, it's reported 3,100 companies have pulled. I'll start again. It is reported that 3,100 companies have pulled their ads from Limbaugh. And the protesters and boycotters have never been closer to pulling Limbaugh off the air. When he has moved on, this country will be all the better, and the public will prove once again it can be done. We can eliminate hate speech from the media if it takes one host at a time. You see, you can toss Americans some Limbaugh, Fox News, Bush, Cheney, Koch brothers, even some Supreme Court corruption. But when push comes to shove, Americans will stand up, show up, take charge, and demand a return to democracy and common decency. Salute to all the major boycotters and volunteers. To learn more about the Rush Limbaugh boycott and protests, visit Boycott Rush Facebook group, Limbaugh sponsor / clear channel / cumulus petition. Join the fight to Flush Rush Facebook group and the Stop Rush extensive sponsor database. Thank you, Cossack Richard Myers. Rest in peace. We will finish this. Very personalized stuff in this article that comes to us from Daily Kos. Namely, Leslie Salzio, Daily Kos member. Okay, that's it. The show's over. We're getting late. It's time for Palestine Today. Talk at you next Monday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. That's 1500 hours Pacific Daylight Time. And, of course, back to begin the end of the reading of Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel on Saturday. This coming Saturday, which is the next time you'll hear from me. Saturday, 11 a.m. PDT. Thanks for listening. Ta-ta.